Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Coppola Conversations, a bonus strand of the podcast where I'll be talking to people who are somehow involved in the films of the Coppola family or have just had their lives moved by the Coppola family in some way or another. Today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Jared Gilman, who is one of the stars of Moonrise Kingdom, which obviously is co-written by Roman Coppola and has a cameo from Jason Schwartzman. This conversation is fantastic. Jared was kind enough to recount some of the stories and go through some of the amazing things that he's managed to keep from the set of the film and some of the life lessons that he learned. He's massively candid and open about his time, and we really got into some stuff that I guess you can only really get from looking back on your time. And for those of you who are fans on Patterson, there's possibly some answers there as well. Before you hear my conversation with Jared, here's a brief clip from the film when Sam and Susie managed to find their own slice of paradise, their Moonrise Kingdom. So I guess there's only one thing left to do, and that's to meet me in the meadow and enjoy this Coppola conversation.
Well, you always use binoculars.
It helps you see things closer.
Even if they're not very far away.
I pretend it's my magic power.
That sounds like poetry. Poems don't always have to rhyme, you know. They're just supposed to be creative. So, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I don't know. I want to go on adventures, I think. Not get stuck in one place. How about you?
Go on adventures too, not get stuck too. Anyway, we can't predict the exact future.
That's true.
It's possible I'm here with the bed, by the way. Later, I mean.
Okay.
I wish I didn't have to mention it, but just in case. I don't want to make you be offended.
Of course I won't.
Today I am here joined by Jared Gilman. Or as many of you may call him, and I'm probably sure he's sick to death of being referred to as that kid from Moonrise Kingdom. How are you, Jared?
I'm all right. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We were just talking off mic about how I'm here to dredge up essentially a film you made a decade ago.
Yeah.
Are you cool with that?
Do you have fond memories of? No, I have
a lot of very fond memories.
I was just going on YouTube watching B-roll footage that you know had been uploaded, just to like jog my memory a little bit. But like, I mean, I still think it was like one of the best, if not the best, experience of my life.
So how did you get the role of Sam? Was it like kind of like open call that you went for, or was it?
So I had auditioned for it a few times over the course of 6 months. So I had my first audition in September 2010, and that was like a cold read audition. So I was not given any material beforehand. It was all the script, the scene that we had to read was given to me when I got there. So I only had like 5 minutes to prep and then go do it. It was a scene that got that I only ever read that one time that I guess Wes must have just cut from future drafts. So there's that, and then I had to do a callback with someone auditioning for Susie, and that was when I first met Wes. It was probably like October, November. And then maybe a couple weeks later I had a second callback with Wes, where I was basically going over, I think it was all the same scenes that I had done in the previous audition, but what had happened was, I guess he had recorded, I hope I'm getting this detail right. I think what had happened was he had like recorded the audio on his iPhone or on someone's iPhone, and something happened when he was uploading the footage onto the computer and the audio got lost. So I had to re-record my audio with him. And, this is what I was told, I think, again, 10 years ago, so I hope I'm getting it right. So there's that. And then I had a final sort of like callback with, it was just the casting directors back in their office where I had the first audition. And it was like reading some of them. There were sort of alternate versions of some of the scenes that, so for example, the dog, spoiler alert, when the dog dies,
it's a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, the dog's always really gonna die. Spoiler. Away. I mean, I get that sentiment. When that scene was initially written to be a bit longer, and it even included like in the script that I read when I first got cast, it was they see the dog with the arrow in it. And Susie starts like having a panic attack or like starting to like freak out. And so then Sam, I guess, because something he learned as a scout, he like lightly slaps her out of it. and so he does that. And then she like gives him like a death stare and socks him in the face. And we filmed that. we filmed that scene. We spent like a whole afternoon filming that scene where Sam and Susie hit each other. And then a couple weeks later, we ended up having we found there's a different location, and we filmed a shorter version of that without the violence. It's funny, initially there were a couple of scenes where Sam and Susie like get into a little bit of a fight each other a little bit, but Wes cut it out because he wanted to make, I guess, because he wanted to make the relationship a bit more sweet and innocent.
So one of the things that both Wes and Roman Coppola say on the Criterion like commentary is that they didn't picture you as like, that wasn't what they pictured.
That's what
of
I heard.
Sam. And like how do you like interpret that kind of?
Well, I mean, I guess statement. I can say is that I saw the animatics before we even shot it. Wes showed Kara and I a few of the scenes as pre-vised animatics. Mm-hmm. 2D storyboards where he was doing all the voices. It was really funny. I had kind of noticed that the cartoon little storyboard Sam didn't really look like me that much. It was like he didn't have the glasses, I don't think, and maybe the hair might have been a different color, or it was, what? I don't know, I just remember thinking like, yeah, I don't quite look like that guy on in the storyboard. But like, you know, I was at that point, I had already gone through that whole process of being cast and meeting Wes a couple times and running lines with him. And then also, by that point, I had been rehearsing, going to Rhode Island once a week to do rehearsals, and then also taking like kayaking lessons and learning how to cook over an open fire and like flip a fish. I had to do lessons for that. But then, you know, I was also going over the lines, making sure that they were making sure that I was like memorized and prepped for when we were actually starting. So when we actually started, I had all my scenes completely like memorized. pretty much. So it was like, it was cool. You're gonna say,
what was the rehearsal process like? Did Wes like give you any films to watch or anything like that? Was he
good? Yeah, he gave Kara and me like a couple of different movies to watch. He had me view Escape from Alcatraz, the Clint Eastwood movie. And sort of, he wanted me to like kind of study the Clint Eastwood's character and and sort of internalize like the resourcefulness aspect mm-hmm. to him, because he's like, you know, escaping from Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Using, you know, like scraps and shit to do things, and like I said, being very resourceful. So I he had me watch that, and then he also I also took a couple like karate lessons or a couple karate Perfect. classes, but it was literally it was like me, 12-year-old me, and a room full of 6-year-olds doing karate. And I just like didn't know, I felt really out of place, and I guess that's just how it works, because it's like the way the, you know, the belts and all that, and like you mm-hmm. you start at, everybody starts out with the same color belt, and so I guess that just, most people when they do karate, they start when they're 6. I don't know. They don't.
Were you essentially were you like Kramer in that episode of Seinfeld where he joins a karate class and kind of like takes all the kids out because he's so much
bigger? I was the opposite. I was getting taken out by the kids. I was just like I don't know how much force I don't know, like, you know, like I don't, I was great, you know, it was like, because like they were tougher than they look, those kids.
They always are.
Well, yeah, like they, you know, they're like, they're already, I'm like 12 years old, but they're already like my size and like pushing me out of the ring really easily. And it was weird. I felt embarrassed on a couple accounts. I felt embarrassed just on the surface level of like being getting my ass kicked by a bunch of like 6-year-olds, but I was also embarrassed because like the coach, the guy, totally caught that I was super embarrassed in the first place. And he made like a comment or something about mm-hmm. it. And I was like, yeah, wow, you can totally tell. And then I never continued any of that after filming.
So obviously you said that Escape from Alcatraz. Was there anything else on the list?
He had all of us. He held like a little screening in like this really nice theater in Rhode Island, where he played a Ken Loach movie, Blackjack. Mm-hmm. That's also similarly about two kids who run away with, who fall in love and run away with each other, even though it's a completely different setting. Mm-hmm. Though still period technically. He had us, he like got us all together and he had us watch that. Then I think he had Kara watch Melody. From the movie from the 70s, again about two like misfit kids meeting and forming like a bond with each other.
Amazing.
He was keeping, you know, he was like prepping us for this movie. Mm-hmm. He definitely did make sure that we were like ready by the time we were stepping on set.
Were you aware of Wes's work before going into Moonrise Kingdom, or were you kind of like...
Well, so I had seen Fantastic Mr. Fox when I was in theaters. And I sort of had this like weird habit when I was like 9 or 10, where I just like turn on my Apple TV and watch random trailers. So like I'd probably seen some of his like either at least posters or trailers for his movies. Definitely Darjeeling Limited. I just always have a memory of like that poster sticking out in my head when I first saw it, before I became aware of who Wes was. But then after I got cast, you know, then my parents and I, we just like watched most of his filmography. We got through everything except for Bottle Rocket by the time Moonrise started. And then when I hit 7th grade, my English teacher lent me his DVD of Bottle Rocket.
He was a
Wes Anderson fan. And he was my English teacher when I was in 6th grade. And I remember after I got cast, I guess word had gotten around the school, and where was a class where he'd like handed back a paper that we had written or something, and I'd gotten a B+ on it. And he was like, "All right, your class is dismissed. Everyone except for Jared. Jared, you have to stay." And I was like, and in the back of my head, I'm thinking, I got a B plus. Is it really that bad? Did everyone else get A's? And he's like, Jared, I just want to say I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan. That's like awesome news. I'm, you know, and then like congratulating me and all that and talking to me about his movies. In fact, he was really the one who like kind of keyed me into sort of the idea that, you know, he was this director with this already very passionate fan base of people that followed his work. And so he kind of gave me that idea, and then of course worked on the movie, and then it came out, and then I really had an idea of his status.
Obviously, looking back on his like filmography, and it's like you mentioned in Fantastic Mr. Fox was the movie before. Mm-hmm. Looking at Moonrise Kingdom now, you can very much see the influence from like the stop animation.
In fact, there's a VFX that was done with me where I was a stop motion human stop motion dummy for about 30 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, right. So like I when I got struck by lightning, sorry if I'm jumping around a lot, but when I got struck by lightning, that was sort of a tricky thing to kind of figure out how they were going to do that. Because initially, I guess Wes thought maybe I'd be, like, attached to, like, a pulley thing that would fly me backward. Something more, like, traditionally practical like that. And we tested it, where they had me, it was pretty basic, or mild. Like, they just had me, like, they tugged my back and I just fell into a mattress. But I was, like, harnessed up. Then what ended up happening, the way that Wes ended up doing it, was that it was literally my last day on set, technically. It was, like, after I filmed everything, and Carrot already wrapped. It was this one morning where I had to walk in to base camp, and they had this set up on the driveway where it was a tent, a tripod with a Canon camera, like, pointing, like, I think it was like a Canon, like DSLR type camera, like, you know, pointing 90 degrees like downward, and green screen on the blacktop, and they had me lying on my side, and they like had me sort of, you know, in like various positions, like as if I'm flying back from being struck by lightning, and you know, taking a picture, then like moving me an inch, taking a photo, moving me an inch, taking a photo. And, you know, it was neat. It was really neat for sure. It was uncomfortable. It, you know, being on your side on like driveway, essentially, even though there's a green screen there, but it's like a really, it's not a thick fabric at all. No cushion, nothing. So then you watch the movie and you see it, it's there for like four frames. You have to pause it. But if you pause it, it's there. It's funny.
I guess it very much plays into the fact that Wes Anderson treats his actors like they're stop animation characters, right?
I had a college professor go on a whole 5-minute rant about it in front of me, not realizing that I was there. Like it was a class all about directing actors, and the professor happened to have some very strong opinions on Wes and his movies, and like went on like a whole 5-minute rant, like rant bit whatever about, you know, where she's like making jokes and shit about it, you know, the way characters move and his frames and the way that they talk and all that. And enough people in the class knew that I was there and like knew about me that like they were giggling and looking back at me. I was sitting in the back of the room, and they were like looking back, and it was, and so then eventually she like stopped and was like, "Oh, what?" She looks at me and she was like, "Oh, what? Is Wes Anderson your uncle or something?" And I was like, "I played Sam in Moonrise Kingdom," and it was sort of this funny thing where she sort of, she had like a couple of different responses at once, but it was, you know, all in good nature, but it was like, you know, it was like, oh, that was the one movie I really liked. That's the one Wes Anderson film I really enjoyed. And then trying to, she asked me, she said a couple other things, I forget now, but it was just like very, you know, it was funny.
So what is it like to be on a Wes Anderson set? Is it a matter of be here, be there? Is it well choreographed, or is there room for fluidity?
Well, like, you know what you're doing. Like, I mean, like, the blocking is usually pretty specific, like, because, you know, there is a very, you know, distinct look to his shots and making sure everything looks visually appealing and framed nicely and all that. And so, like, I get, you know, that, like, I got what he was trying to do, I feel like, and it wasn't, like, a big deal or anything. It was, you know, if anything, it made me feel a lot better about what I was doing because, you know, it was whatever I was doing, it was working, and, you know, everyone's spirits were really good in the shoot, and it was, you know, and, like, I'm not gonna say that, like, when I was working on it, I knew it was gonna be what it was or anything like that, but, like, I had a sense that we were doing something pretty, you know, it was like we were working on something really good, and exciting and all that. But like, so then, I'm sorry if I'm like dancing around the question. I don't mean to. But yeah, I mean, like, so, you know, we didn't do any like improvising or anything like that. The closest thing, I guess, to like improv, there were, and I could be wrong about this, but I seem to remember that, like, there were little moments, like, when Sam and Susie are going through the woods together that like, we filmed that I don't remember being in the script, and I can't think of the moments themselves anymore, but, like, I just remember, like, you know, remember, like, I'm pretty sure some of that might not have been in the script and have just been storyboarded, and were ideas that was had maybe from location scouting or something. I'm not sure. I'm guessing at that. I don't quote me on that. But like, there was that. But otherwise, everything that was scripted, we were verbatim. And then, you know, like I said, there was one scene that, you know, there were a couple of scenes that got shifted a little bit. Like, there the dog scene that got changed, but even then, we were still sticking to like what was on the script. I mean, yeah, I think a lot of the sort of character building stuff probably happened during the rehearsals, and then when we were on set, it was more about getting it right on, like, a technical, like, making sure that, like, the pacing and the rhythm of the words worked for what he was going for and stuff like that. Yeah, then it kind of did involve some more, like, more very specific directions, I guess, about pacing. But yeah, I mean, I think.
So, what was the vibe like on the set? I know that Edward Norton said it was somewhat like a summer camp.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, like, well, so, like, there weren't any trailers on the set. There were Coleman tents, and you know, you show up in costume and makeup, pretty much fully done for the most part, so, like, it, you know, it's a bit of a unique vibe for a set. And I think, obviously, the fact that it's a summer camp movie really added to that. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was also, too, for me, you know, and also all the child actors in the movie, we all had, you know, it wasn't just going there to film a movie, but we also had to do school as well. So when you're a minor, you have to do a certain amount of hours of schooling every week. And I was missing the last, like, 2 months of sixth grade. So it was like catching up on all like the final stuff, all the fun things you really want to be there for, but I wasn't. I remember I had this essay for my humanities class that the on-set tutors made me rewrite like two or three times, and I was not happy about it. First off, in general, writing essays is still to this day it can be anxiety inducing for me. So, like, even back then, it wasn't something that, like, I enjoyed. And so it was, like, essay on American history or something. And I wrote it, like, three times. And then I handed it, I emailed it, and then I got an A+. It was, like, maybe my only A+ in middle school. I can't remember anymore. But it was sort of when I was working on it, it was, like, balancing those two things. It was, like, working, being in character, but then also being me, a student in sixth grade, finishing the year off. I ended up finishing, like, I think a week or two after all my classmates did. Like, they, you know, classes ended, like, mid-May or end of May or something, and I ended up finishing, like, at the beginning of June was when I finished all my work. And then we ended up, then I had, like, the last three or four weeks, or I guess, like, 3 weeks then, where I was not in school, and it was a lot of fun until I got a cold. I got a really bad cold at the end of shooting.
That wasn't fun, but then I got better, and then the shoot ended, and the rest is history.
You obviously mentioned working with Kara quite a lot. What was it like working with some of, like, well, the heavy hitters that we've got in this film? And you get, like, some kind quite intense scenes with, like, Ed Norton and Bruce Willis. What were those guys like to work with? Like, obviously, how did you feel at the time? Was it like, shit, these are, like, big deals? Or were you kind of, I have no idea, I'm just a 12-year-old kid, I don't really know Bruce
Willis. No. I at that point, I'd already, like, watched Ghostbusters a million times at that point, and was very much a big Bill Murray fan. you know, I'd seen that. I'd seen What About Bob? A few of them by that point. There's that, and then Bruce Willis. I made sure that I watched Die Hard before we started filming. And then Ed Norton, I did not watch Fight Club. I was a little too young at that point. I didn't see Fight Club until 3 years later. But I had seen The Incredible Hulk, so I was like, I knew who he was at that point. Right? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
2008. All that time ago. But I knew who I was working with for sure, and I was very excited. And I had a good time, you know. Like I wasn't because Sam doesn't have many scenes at all. Really, like you said, just like one real scene with the police chief, and then one other one with Scoutmaster Ward. So it's you know, we weren't like always with each other, but like when we were filming those scenes, you know, we were usually, because you know, when you're in that mode, you're just focused on, you know, getting the work done. So it wasn't like we were like really interacting that much, but you know, they were nice, and Bruce was really nice. The day we filmed his scene, like he we ran lines with each other like maybe 20 minutes beforehand. Because he tapped me on the shoulder and asked to, you know, like, he was proactive, I guess, in that way. But that was a long morning. We spent like a whole morning filming that.
Yeah,
or a good amount of that scene. We didn't do it in one day. We had to do most of it during a morning, and then we filmed another bit of it. The shot where the wall is supposed to be, where it's that like reverse angle on two of them. That was shot in a separate day, where they had that whole set, like the wall removed, so the camera would be there, and it was at night on a weekend. I think it was like the one weekend that I had to work. It was either a weekend or it was a day that I was told I was not going to need to work. It was something like that, where it was like, because I didn't have a single day off when I worked on the movie, and except for one day that I was told was going to be my day off, but then like. At like 3 or 4 p.m. they called us being like, hey, can Jared come back to set? We need him for a couple of shots. And so, you know, I was there, of course.
This topic we're kind of floating around kind of perfectly like ties into one of the questions I was asked by someone on Twitter to ask you, which was like, what kind of lessons did you learn from this film? Whether it was like from stuff that Wes did, or like, yeah, that you kind of took away and learned from making this film?
Well, on a practical, not really film related level, Bill Murray taught me how to tie a tie.
Perfect.
I mean, I have to think about that for sure. I mean, like, I think like, I definitely walked away with a lot from the movie for sure. I mean, I walked away, you know, having an idea of like how to make a movie or how movies are made, you know, like having a lot more insight to the production side. In a way, you know, obviously as an actor, there's only so much you're exposed to. And especially as a child actor too, you know. So it wasn't, you know, but like, I guess, you know, something I guess, I don't, okay, so like, what I will say to you is, I think the year after that was my bar mitzvah, and I, part of the thing is that you have to give like a little speech talking about the Torah portion that you've memorized and the lessons that you can learn from it or whatever. And I somehow was like able to relate it back to Wes, and like just like the idea of being like a kind leader, and like, I don't know, like being the sort of like power that like being a like a not an asshole or not, you know, in a positive way, like being a good person, or just being like, you know, a good, like a kind-hearted leader or whatever. I forget exactly what I was talking about, but I guess like if I'm thinking back to my mindset when I was 12 years old and like what I was thinking at the time, it was, you know, like that's kind of what I was probably taking away at that point.
So obviously,
because I just remember thinking, you know, like that, like he's this guy who's got this whole production on his shoulders, and it's like all these people and all this shit, you know, is ratting on him, and he's, you know, able to like make it work, and not just him, but any director doing this, you know, and that was kind of what was going through my head, I think, at the time.
And obviously, he like kind of breaks one of the cardinal rules of filmmaking, which is never work with kids, right?
Well, it's never work with kids and never work with animals. Well, that, and he
kills
both.
Yeah, he normally kills off a lot of the dogs in his movies, or at least
there's a cat in this one too that does not die. The cat dies in Grand Budapest, but yeah, the cat was originally supposed to be a dog, I think, but then switched.
Yeah, well, yeah.
For the better, I really love that. That cat was adorable when he wasn't scratching your eyes out. Or not, he didn't scratch anyone's eyes. I'm just being hyperbolic. But he was like, the cat was like somehow aware of whenever the camera was rolling. And like when the camera was rolling, would like calm down and like be good and not loud or scratchy or whatever. The second cut, you know, the second it heard cut, it was like it became a diva and, you know, just like impatient, running around everywhere and like, you know, scratching you if you try and pick it up or whatever,
demanding catnip.
However really good for Ed Norton, really good for Edward Norton. Like where the because there's the, you know, the moment when Sam and Susie are on the ferry being taken back by everyone else, and in the background of one of the shots you can see the little scouts like playing with the cat. And like that's like legit. That was like what they were doing during that day. That was like what you know, what was going on. But then the cat was on Edward's lap and was apparently totally fine and super sweet, super kind, almost as if the cat knew, you know, that it was on the lap of like an A-lister.
So it's on the lap of the Hulk, guys. It's gotta behave.
I guess going back to your question about like working with all of them, I should say, like, you know, they were all really nice. You know, I barely met Tilda. I saw her like a few times, but the few times I saw her, she was great. And then when we went to Cannes and the movie premiered, I was sitting right next to her. And because it was the opening movie of the festival, so they had like the host come out, and then all the judges came out. So it was like a whole kind of like ceremony that happened before the screening even started, but it was all in French. And so Tilda was like leaning over to me and kind of translating it into my ear.
Perfect.
That whole experience was fucking so fucking surreal on like a different level than shooting. But so then there was that. Then Bill was, like I said, he taught me how to tie a tie, and it was a spur of the moment thing. It was like I was doing a costume fitting for the last outfit that I wear in the movie, which is like the mini me Captain Sharp outfit. And at least that's how I think I was like dubbing it mini me Captain Sharp, or that's what we were all calling it. When we were on set. but or maybe not. Maybe I'm remembering that wrong. But I could. I might not be. That might be what we were calling it. But I was doing the fitting, and I was 12 years old. I didn't know how to tie a tie yet. I hadn't really had to wear one very often. And it just so happened that Bill was like right there, because the waiting room was right next to where the costumes were, and you could overhear what was going on. And he looked up from his newspaper and he was like, "Jared, come over here, I'll teach you." And so I walked over and he knelt down and he taught me. And it proved very useful for the following year, because I was going into seventh grade, turning 13, having all the bar and bat mitzvahs to go to. I had my bar mitzvah. It was, you know, very, very helpful skill.
And you were there whipping that tie, doing it mm-hmm. straight away. Mm-hmm. God bless Bill Murray for teaching Jared to do his tie. One of the things I...
Frances McDormand, she was, I had like no scenes with her, but like she was amazing, like super, super nice, like really sweet. Watching, seeing her getting all the award stuff was a lot of fun. Both years, I guess. Yeah. And then Jason Schwartzman was also.
Yeah. What was that? What was that day? I guess it would have been a day, right?
It was a week. It was like a week or two. And he was super chill. It was funny, apparently, and I didn't learn this until afterwards, I think. Apparently the producers were telling him to not talk to us as much and kind of be a little more mysterious, or I guess like I don't know, because I guess something to help with, I don't know, like the character relationship, even though I remember hearing him say that in an interview or whatever, but he just kind of got very carried away just like talking to us about his, other shoots and things and joking around and stuff. He was a really nice guy.
Well, I guess for him as well, for like, he would have seen some parallels with you guys, right? Because obviously like that was his introduction to...
In a way, yeah.
Film was a Wes Anderson movie, right? Obviously it was
Rushmore.
Yeah, that slight bit older, but I guess he would have like been in that position of being like, shit, I remember what it was like to kind of not know what I was doing and then kind of being put into this
granted, like, you know, at that point Wes Anderson world had been a little bit less established in the world, our world, when Rushmore was happening, I think like there might have been some of that for sure, but like he was pretty chill.
And so obviously at the moment I'm looking
about Balaban was awesome too.
I
remember that, and at the end of like the first week I helped him. He was trying to figure out something on his iPad and I helped him. I forget what, maybe it was slowing the volume or something like that, I forget, but he was super, he was really kind too.
I kind of always forget like how many people there are in that
movie, no, right? I know, right? And then like Harvey Keitel too, I met him very briefly, but the funny thing about when I met him was that I was doing a makeup test for when I get struck by lightning, mm-hmm. and I sit back up into the frame and I'm all covered in soot and like all charred up, so that was when I met Harvey Keitel, was when I was like all made up like that. It was funny because like he saw me, and I guess he knew the script, so like he knew who I was, and so he saw what I, you know, he saw me, and he started laughing. He was like, "Oh, you must be Sam," and I was like, "Yeah, nice to meet you." That was pretty much it. I didn't really have any real interaction beyond like a handshake, but then I think he like bought the cast like lunch or lemonade. Jason Schwartzman brought a lemonade stand one time. Harvey Keitel may have given, he gave cupcakes after he wrapped. He gave the cast like cupcakes or something like that after he wrapped.
What a guy. How is it to kind of like see some of these people's like films after the fact? Obviously you've had this experience with Harvey Keitel, and then I'm not sure if you've seen something like Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant.
I haven't seen, what I'll say is I haven't seen Bad Lieutenant yet.
There's one thing I really wanted to talk about, especially in regards to this, well, yeah, in regard to this film, is some people's perception of it after the fact, and the sexualization, that like people's perception of the sexualization of yourself and Kara, like, was yeah. were you aware of it at the time, or like looking back on it, how do you kind of like look at those opinions, and how was that like handled on set?
Sure, yeah. Well, what I'll say is, like, I mean, when it was happening, like, I understood, you know, like, I understood, like, what was going on, like, with the characters. Like, I knew what my, you know, I knew what the lines meant. Like, it wasn't like there was any kind of confusion there or whatever. And it was also the last thing that Kara and I shot together, pretty much. They made sure to save that for the end of production because they wanted to make sure that we were really comfortable with each other and with like working on set and everything. And also too, it was a closed set, so it was just only the people who needed to be there, like the production people. So like it was like Wes, Bob, the DP, maybe someone on boom, maybe, like it was only a few people, and we blocked it out beforehand and rehearsed everything, and you know it was done pretty, you know, from obviously I can only speak for myself, but like I felt safe and I felt okay. I felt, you know, like it was another day of work. So obviously then, you know, seeing it after the fact and then having your friends watch it rag on you for it and all that, that happened to me for sure. I had definitely had people giving me a little bit of shit for it, but like it's what it is. I don't read anything and, you know, anything bad or anything like that into it. Like I don't see anything like that.
Yeah, so I'd watched the movie a few weeks ago and kind of I then realized that I relate more to the parents in this film. Do you know what I mean? I relate more to Scoutmaster Ward or the Bishop parents, or even like Captain Sharp,
like trying to get a handle on these kids.
And it's just that thing, I think,
being past that point in life and looking back and
that the film works perfectly on that kind of like dual level, that like if you kind of see it at a younger age, you will kind of relate to that thing of you, and I guess even as older you can kind of get that nostalgia to look at like your first love or whatever. But then, like, yeah, it's kind of watching it being a parent now. And then it's like that thing of, like, the moments between, like, Francis and Bill. It's like, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, they're heartbreaking. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think, like, when you realize it's like, because then it's like, I kind of had never really picked up on that thing that it's about that first love and the kind of breakdown of love as well, like that you get through them. And it's I back to the point of like how
it's also, I love how it handles the adult character relationships and like a very, you know, it's all like there, but it's there if you're paying, you know, if you notice it. So like the Scoutmaster Ward and the woman who's doing the handling the
switchboard operator, right?
The switchboard operator, yeah. They have there's sort of a little Easter egg, like relationship thing by the end of the movie, where like she offers some cookies and then later her picture replaces the Harvey Keitel's picture and on his like desk in the final scene or something. So like there are lots of little details like that, that like that was something I learned too, I think, at that time, at that age, like that you can put things in movies and people can notice them on repeat viewings, and that, you know, makes it, you know, much feel a lot more whole and like deeper and all that. And just the idea, you know, the idea of even just like the idea of like doing shots to achieve an emotional effect as opposed to just like doing shots to do shots. That was something that like I that doing that movie taught me for sure.
So you're at NYU, right? Do you like have plans, or like do you have aspirations to be a director yourself in the future, or are you kind of playing it by ear?
Yeah, it's like I'm happy, and this is maybe I'm like to, you know, looking back at my time at NYU now, you know, because it's like I've been home for a year plus mm-hmm. now, and there were things I obviously really enjoyed. I enjoy working on things like on sets and stuff and directing on set. I get really stressed out with the prep stuff. I get really stressed out by school stuff. I get really, you know, it's like everything that's like the school that surrounds the film part of film school is like stressful for me. And it makes the filming part, it can sometimes make it detract from it. And this, you can cut it or whatever, you can do whatever. This is just me, I guess, speaking a bit more openly and honestly than I don't know, just because I don't like bullshitting people about my views on things.
It's just that somebody actually asked me, like, slid into my DMs when I did the call and kind of like said, like, they're thinking of applying to NYU's graduate film program.
Okay. I mean, I have no sort of, I don't really know about the graduate program, obviously, as an undergrad, so I cannot speak to the quality of the program there. And that's to say, I can't speak to, you know, I have no other preference for film schools. So it's like, I could be really spoiled, right? You know, like, I don't know. And so it's like, and so it's, it, yeah, I mean, and so, yeah, I guess, what I'm trying to say, it's like I'm debating about how much I want to graduate, that kind of thing. Admittedly, and the reason I say you can cut this is because I guess I just feel a little weird talking about it like in a public way.
Of course.
I'm
more than happy to cut it,
because I get where I Because I get like the importance of film school and the idea, and the fact that like if you don't do it and you don't get a degree, it's a lot harder for you to get work as a filmmaker. But even if you do go and get a degree, it's still going to be really hard to get work as a filmmaker. And for me, it was just like I enjoy being on set and just creating things and doing things over again and getting sort of closer to a sense of perfection or a sense of like satisfaction with on an artistic sense. And I guess I just feel like all this other stuff just gets in the way of it for me.
I guess you kind of have to weigh up that.
And like, I get that, like, that's kind of part of it is the other stuff kind of part of it. And that's kind of just like, and it's sort of like, I kind of have it. And so that's kind of what whereas with acting, that's something that I enjoy doing and I don't have any of these kinds of grievances with. It's like when I do an audition for something, it feels like an escape, from the school or whatever that I'm like, or whatever, you know. And so it's like, you know, if someone were to ask me, like, if they wanted to go, if they're looking at NYU as a school mm-hmm. to go to, and you know, I don't want to look like I'm, you know, I don't, I guess also because it's such a big choice to make, it to me thinking that I had any influence on that is like, I had a very 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 specific experience that maybe you won't have, maybe you'll have a much better experience, maybe you'll get, you know, you'll form relationships easier and schedules will line up better. And it's like there's factors that went into the sort of the experience that I had that like I realized might be unique, not just me on a selfish level, but just on an individual level. The fact that I'm an individual like going through a system that hundreds of thousands go through, and so it's
I know exactly what you're
talking about. It's hard, you know.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I get it with being a parent. My sister's recently like had a kid, and like my mom said, oh yeah, you can give her advice. It's like, I know what to do with my kid. I don't know what to do with someone else's kid. I'm like, they're completely different. It kind of like plays to your point of like, nobody wants that. Nobody wants to be making decisions for other people. So let's kind of do like, a few, I've got a couple of fun questions here.
Cool.
One of them is from the person I recorded the conversation about Moonrise Kingdom with, kind of dissecting the film, Jeanette. She wanted to know, did you get any souvenirs from the set of Moonrise Kingdom?
So I did. No main props or main, like what they call hero costumes or props or anything like that. However, I got some backup stuff. So, right there is a backup coonskin cap.
Perfect.
And then, there's the, like the mask that I'm wearing in the church.
Amazing.
And then if you mind the possibly on-screen ashtray. No, it's not. Never mind. What ashtray? there's a backup version of the backpack.
That's amazing.
Then the other sort of souvenir that wasn't really a prop, but I consider a souvenir. This is going to be a little bong cameo, possibly. What bong? No bong. Never mind. Hey. Oh, wait. No, we moved it. Shit. Damn. Okay. Never mind. Yeah, I have a. Must be in my closet. Maybe I have. When I was working when I was rehearsing for the movie, when I had to do kayaking lessons, they gave me like a practice oar to like
get the
rehearse the stroke with. And so then what happened was that midway through production, my mom got the idea of having all the cast and crew sign it.
Oh, amazing.
And so that's what we did. And so by the end of the shoot, I think 98% of people had put their, you know, ink on it and put their signature on it. And for a while, it was on my wall. It was there somewhere. But we've like, you know, rearranged, you know, my room a few times.
I don't know. You ought to be asking a family member. That might be on eBay somewhere.
Yeah, it might be. It might be in my closet somewhere. But yeah. So like there that. Oh yeah, and then I got a backup version of the glasses.
That's wonderful. It's great. Like.
So yeah, some backup stuff. No costume. No scout uniform.
The other things you wanted to know as well, and I think you've kind of answered it, is there any skills you learned making that film? Like you obviously said, you learned to kayak somewhat.
Well, so skills that I learned, it was skills that I learned for the movie, not for my own personal life. So once the film wrapped, maybe I can still flip a fish. Who knows? I haven't done it since. I really don't know. I'd maybe want to try it not over fire first. But yeah.
Wonderful. Well, before I let you
tying go, a tie, that's the skill that I took with me.
Exactly. By the master, Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. I'd be remiss not to ask you as well, are Susie and Sam in Patterson? Is that the deal with your cameo in Patterson?
Spiritually, maybe they're not Sam and Susie, but like other S names, Steve and Samantha. Wait a second, that's another Sam. I don't know, but we didn't name them. They were male student and female student. In the script, But that was like what I can say is that was like an homage to Wes.
Yeah.
And for sure, that was, you know, Jim was open about that intent with us.
So yeah, what was that like? Was that just like a day, just kind
that
of like
day. That was a day. That was not a week. That was a day. He had us meet with him in his office in New York City. And he offered the scene to us, and we were like, yes, of course. And we met him again for rehearsal, and then I think again for I had to go for a brief costume fitting, and then it was the day we shot it, and it was Columbus Day 2015. So I had the day off from school, which was really great because I got all my done over the weekend, and then I had no on-set school or anything.
Perfect.
I could just go ride the bus, do the scene, eat lunch, go back on the bus, do the rest of the scene, meet Adam Driver, and then wrap.
What was Adam Driver like? Was it,
so I met him. I've only met him twice for like 30-second intervals, but he was nice in those 30 seconds. Like, because when we were shooting our scene, the driver was a stunt driver, because at that point he hadn't gotten his bus license yet. Because he was working. He did the work, he got the license for the movie. So when he's driving the bus, the shots of him driving the bus are him driving the bus. But I guess before then, they were doing all the coverage of all the passengers and all that, where he was off screen so they could have a stunt person doing it. But when we wrapped our scene, that was when he arrived, when Adam Driver arrived, and he walked into the bus, shook hands, and he asked for us to just run the scene again for him. So he had something to kind of listen to in his head when they were getting his coverage of that moment. It's interesting because this was like right before Force Awakens came out. Mm-hmm. So like everyone knew that he was Kylo Ren, but nobody had seen the movie yet. So it was like, it was that glory period, you know, the hype thing.
So, well, yeah, one person I kind of, because obviously at the moment I'm like looking at the Coppola family as
So then I do have another, besides Jason Schwartzman, obviously, they're the other connection. Geographically, I have a connection, but sorry, you're going to say.
I was going to say, like, what was like Roman's involvement? Roman Coppola's involvement?
Oh, yeah, and then Roman too, yeah.
Was he there for like rehearsals, or was he on set at all? Was he kind of like...
Sorry for interrupting.
No.
He was on set for... I distinctly remember seeing him on set once. He could have been there more, and I just missed it. That's could totally be the case, for sure, because there were a lot of people in that set. And obviously, I'm not a god. I can't be everywhere. So it's like, you know, I can only remember where I was. But I do remember there was one day that I did see him on set. I was inside the tent, and it was on the beach, and I could see him through a little screen in the back of the tent. And then the next time I saw him was on a plane to Cannes, and it was actually kind of funny because. When I went to Cannes, I had to take two flights. I went to took the first flight to Paris, and then I had to take a connecting flight from there to Cannes. And I saw him on that connecting flight, but it was after the flight had taken off. We got on the plane. I immediately conked out and like fell asleep, and then woke up and we were like several thousand feet in the air. And I woke up, see him over to my left taking a drag of a cigarette. And I immediately was like, what the fuck? You're not what the fuck, because I'm 13. I was like, what the hell? I don't know. But I just remember being like, what? And then I guess it was like a fake cigarette, and I guess those are allowed. I don't know. I just remember just that journey to Cannes, almost in a way it was like a dream, because I was constantly falling asleep. Because it was, you know, a long flight to Paris, and then I was in the airport. We had to wait for like another hour, mm-hmm. 2 hours in line, and I was like getting hit with the jet lag and, mm-hmm. and general fatigue and all that, and so like I just was like going in and out of sleep, and so it's like I fall asleep, I wake up next to Roman Coppola smoking a fake cigarette, and then we land, and then I leave the airport right behind Alexander Payne, and then get immediately mobbed by like French paparazzi. It was like very surreal.
Yeah,
Cannes is an extremely, when the festival is happening and you're an actor in one of those movies, it is very surreal, because it's just like you can't go anywhere without people taking your photo. It was like, and my dad was actually getting kind of like, he was getting annoyed by the end of it. He was like ready to leave. He was like ready like to get out of there, getting you know, leaving all the paparazzi people getting in our way.
Yeah, but, the closest like I can have to like that experience, like nowhere near it, is I made the mistake of, well, not even made the mistake. I went to Berlin, and it happened to be the weekend that the Berlin Film Festival was on, and it was around the time of the Isle of Dogs premiere. And,
oh, like, yeah, that must have been pretty big.
Berlin was swamped, and like because I was just, I don't know, must have been an ignorant idiot at the time. I like kind of realized, like, I was like, why is it so busy everywhere? Why is our Airbnb so far out of town? And then I realized, like, oh, literally the whole film world has descended onto Berlin. And
yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah, so I'm really hesitant to ask you this question, but so many people have asked me to ask you, so I have to ask it, Jared. What kind of bird are you?
I don't know, pigeon.
Okay, it's out of the way. It's out of the way, guys. I asked it. Okay, I hope you're all happy now. I'm conscious of taking up too much of your time, so I'll ask you. One last question. Sure. The reason I started podcasting for some reason was to talk about Nicolas Cage. Are you?
Yeah, I've been meaning to mention this to you.
Are you a Nicolas Cage fan?
Oh, yes, yes, of course, of course. That goes without saying. But what I was gonna say was that we filmed for, I want to say it was like a week or so, maybe at least a few days, on his former property, mm-hmm. former mansion that he once owned in Rhode Island. So it's the scenes when, in fact, it's like the pre, it's all the like Sam and Susie's like first campsite mm-hmm. that then gets like found by the other scouts later on. So it's like the scene where he cooks over the open fire and then they catch the turtle and then they unpack luggage and he laughs at her book and then does the apologizes and all that. So that was all shot on in like the back of his mansion, storm room. I did not get a tour of the place. I didn't really walk around, but it looked huge. It was ginormous. It looked like a mansion that Nicolas Cage would live in at some point.
I was gonna say, were there rumors?
The property was really beautiful too.
Yeah,
the property was really beautiful too, and that was again those that wide shot. You know, wide shot of us in the camp on the campsite with the little cliff by the water. That's Nick Cage's former property.
Wow!
So just like have that in the back of your head when you watch it.
Amazing. Well, Jared, thank you so much for your time and talking about a film that just happened for you so long ago. Do you have anything in the pipeline that you can kind of like let us know about, or is it kind of 2020 hit you as much as it's hit the rest of us?
Well, so yeah, so like I need to resume finishing up my I directed like an intermediate movie at NYU. It's the level below advanced. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a little like it's like a 4-minute little short I shot it. It's already been edited and the sound design. I just have to like figure out music and then color correction and that stuff. But I'll admit the pandemic in a way ruined my sort of work ethic.
Yeah, like it has.
When it comes to like,
it's happened worldwide. Don't
when it comes to like. Getting, I don't know, movies made, it, I guess. And so it's like, I need to just find myself a moment where I have nothing to do and I just put it in front of my face and I just start playing music in front of it to see what I like. Because what I'm planning, I think, on doing is like figuring out if there's a track or something, like a tone or something that I want for the moments that I'd like want a little music for. And then I'll probably go on maybe Facebook or something and like, there's a Facebook group for Tisch students making movies, and I'll probably just be like, hey, anybody want to do a little like 15 seconds of music for me? and then coloring and then credits. So there's that, and then as for acting work, I'm auditioning. I've had auditions in the previous couple months. Okay. I guess what I'll say to that is that, and this for anybody listening, is that if you follow me on Twitter and you notice that I shave my face, basically I only ever shave for auditions. So that's the clue. I ever post a picture of me clean shaven, it's because I'm auditioning for something.
Perfect. So, one of the things I wanted to ask you right before you go is, how does it feel when you see like a new Wes Anderson film come out? And obviously, he's famous for like working with the same people. Sure,
yeah, no, I mean, like, it's a nostalgia hit. It's a giant nostalgia hit. It's like seeing all the names of people that I remember from when I was 12, and also just, you know, because it's a Wes Anderson movie, so you know he has that feeling to it, and that obviously makes me, you know, feel very nostalgic. So it admittedly, I get kind of sad. I don't know, because I miss it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been so long, and I still have very strong feelings, and so you know, it's like, it. And you know, his birthday is coming up pretty soon. I'm gonna send him a birthday email.
Do you ever get the like urge to be like watching, say, like, I don't know, Grand Budapest Hotel, and you see like Lucas Hedges is character, like,
also Gabe, Gabriel Rush is in it he's the one who they give who becomes the new lobby boy at the end.
So yeah, when you see people like that, do you go like, Hey Wes, like, is there part of you that's like, hey Wes, where was my phone call for this role, or are you kind of cool with it?
I mean, also they were shooting that in like in the middle of Europe, and I think it was sort of a scheduling thing that kind of worked yeah. out like that. I never try and take anything like that personally. No. I mean, I don't know. He's a director that's got to make his movies, and obviously, if he thinks of me for something, I'll obviously be game for it the second he asks. Like, even if it's only for 90 frames of the movie, I will be in those 90 frames. But you know, like, I get that. Like, you know, he's at a certain status now. I feel like that. You know, where. You know, everyone is like an A-lister in his movies, and so I get that, like, if there's some kind of, like, I don't know, producing reason or whatever, I'm just insinuating. I have no idea. Obviously, if he ever asks me to do something, I'm gonna say yes, and I don't feel any kind of offense that I haven't worked with him since.
I have a feeling that like his final film will kind of be like a greatest hits of everyone who's ever been in his movies. So like, I feel like, Jim, and that would be the ultimate way for Wes Anderson to close out his career. Jared, yeah. Again, thank you so much for coming and chatting to me about this movie.
This is a lot of fun. Thank you for having me, and best of luck as a dad during these times.
Thanks, man. And there we have it. That was the fantastic Jared Gilman. Thank you once again to Jared for coming and talking to me about this slice of nostalgia that means so much to myself, and I imagine so many others. And a massive thank you to all of you guys who submitted your questions for me to ask Jared. Hopefully I got to all of them. And if I didn't, I do apologize. There's all the stuff I want to talk to. And I could have talked to Jared for ages as well. We kind of did as well. We had a little chat before we started recording. We had a little chat afterwards. We actually found out that when I was living in Brighton in 2019, Jared was there for a kind of Wes Anderson event that I'm sure if I didn't have a tiny child at the time, I would have certainly been at. Next week on the main podcast, I will be talking to Freudian cinephile, podcast host and lecturer Mary Wilde all about Sofia Coppola's Somewhere. So if you've seen that film, please don't hesitate to get in touch, which you can do via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and Letterboxd at @CagedInPod, or you can always send me an email, cagedinpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, there's plenty of Coppola and Nick Cage episodes to dive back into. So if you could be so kind to rate, review, subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or whichever podcast platform you're listening to this on right now. As always, guys, I've been Petros Patsilouis, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it Coppola, and I'll catch you next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.